Greetings, this is Will Evans, and we're shifting gears. We all know the price of everything and the true cost of almost nothing. And we're finding the environmental impact is becoming a key calculation in doing business. In this time of climatic and economic confusion, a measure of success will be the extent to which we meet our energy needs and protect our farms, food, and soil fertility. Today we have two guests engaged in a farming endeavor. With us are George Stranahan and Morgan Williams. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
George, you've worn many hats over the years, and all along you've been clearly and consistently rooted in the soil as a farmer.
That's true. I ran the Victory Garden for my family in 1942.
Oh, that's a good history. And Morgan, you're a recent graduate and now an entrepreneur and executive director of a new program.
That's correct. Flux Farm Foundation. I was fortunate enough to be able to come back to the Roaring Fork Valley after my college education in Western North Carolina.
So what's your opinion? Can we grow our economy without destroying the fertility of our soil?
Well, that's to be determined on the quality of life we'd really like to have and the quantity of life we'd really like to have. At the current rate, it's my belief that the U.S. quantity of life is not sustainable for everyone else in the world over the long run.
And you have a plan to do that. Tell us the name of your new business and your purpose.
Well, about 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, through discussions with George, we created Flux Farm Foundation to really address what the future of agriculture holds for the interior West and what opportunities involving renewable energy and carbon sequestration could be value-added opportunities for ranchers and farmers in the interior West. So we're addressing many of the questions that are inherent to that approach and trying to get to the bottom of how, if, when, and how much it will cost to make that transition if it's actually a viable opportunity.
Flux Farm. And tell us what flux means so our listeners will understand.
Well, flux is actually an old word. I mean, calculus used to be called fluxions. And we used the word flux for the magnetic field strength. We used it in a term that people often talked about the amount of energy per unit area coming from the sunlight. That's called the solar flux. And we use it in that sense, that we are going to farm the solar flux.
Tell us why the work of Flux Farms is important and what's happening in this phase of your project.
Well, it's important, A, because agriculture in the interior West is largely a money-losing endeavor, we feel. People have a cultural connection to the land, and they're farming cows and hay, but largely losing money in that endeavor. And with that, land is being sold off to other ventures, real estate development, golf courses. Really looking at why our project, we feel, is important is to keep agricultural land productive in the sense that it's actually producing agricultural value, whether it's energy, whether it's feed and fiber, what that is. It's really addressing some of those issues. And we really hope and we think that energy farming could potentially be a solution to diversifying the incomes of ranchers in the interior West.
So as I understand it, you're advocating for a connection between Intermountain Western land and the farmers and the ranchers and the renewable biofuel network. That seems like a wonderful idea.
Well, it does seem like a wonderful idea. However, there are significant obstacles to that dream. One, the productivity of the land that is in the Intermountain West is not nearly as high as some of the other agricultural land in the United States or in the world. We have low rainfall. Some of our soils are shallow and not full of the nutrients that are in the Midwest. And our seasons are very limited by the climate. Some places there might only be 50 to 60 days of actually productive climate in the area. So there are limitations to what we're trying to look for, but we have a lot of land. There's about 150 million acres of private pasture land in that Intermountain West area, and there's a lot of sunlight. So if we can find a way to effectively sustainably, economically farm that flux, we might be onto something.
That's a huge amount of land.
It's a significant land resource, yes.
Yeah, if you multiply that 150 million by something like 10 tons an acre per year, things are starting to count.
Right. And you've got an experiment on the back burner that's about to move forward. Would you tell us what that experiment is and when you're going to launch it?
Well, our experiment, which came out of sort of a long literature review of what types of carbon sequestration opportunities really make sense, and carbon sequestration meaning pulling carbon out of the global carbon cycle that largely moves through photosynthesis into biomass, and then the decomposition of that biomass back into CO2 by microorganisms. So looking at ways to trap that carbon, mitigate global warming in a way that really makes sense, that can be monitored, and it's cost effective. So our research is looking into a product called biochar, which is a very special product that's formed by the partial combustion of biomass in an oxygen-limited environment, somewhat like a kiln. So the biochar has very, very interesting physical structures and physical properties. It's not a fertilizer. It's just a soil amendment that, when put into the soil, can affect things like water retention and nutrient availability. So we're looking into actually how this char can be integrated into pasture lands and what the impact could potentially be for forage yield, soil chemical and microbial properties after the application of the biochar.
And even in the production of the biochar, you may get some fuel.
That's correct. It's called pyrolysis, the technology that processes biomass into biochar. And that process simultaneously creates a solid, a liquid, and a gas. And the solid is the char, which is high in carbon content. The liquid and the gas are somewhat crude bioenergy feedstocks that can be then processed into value-added fuels, whether it's transportation fuels or feedstock to the chemical industry.
And why would biochar potentially be significant?
Well, biochar could potentially be very significant, A, because it simultaneously could potentially sequester large amounts of carbon into the soil while simultaneously increasing soil fertility, which is something that many of the other concepts don't really approach, is the soil fertility aspect, and feeding the soil is most certainly important if we want agricultural viability over the long run.
And there's a lot of press about biochar right now, some pro, some con.
That's right. There's still a lot of questions that need to be addressed before mainstream application of biochar can occur. It is being discussed on very high levels in policy. The United Nations Climate Change Committee has fast-tracked biochar as a near-term approach to address global warming. So it is being discussed at the level of the United Nations, and research is occurring among all levels of academia, both in Europe, Oceania, South America, United States. Cornell University has quite a bit of biochar research going on, as does the USDA Agricultural Research Service. They're looking into biochar as well. So it's something that is most certainly of interest to soil microbiologists and soil chemists, and even getting the attention of many policymakers.
And really putting charcoal into the soil is not new. Can you tell us a little history?
Well, there is a little history that in Amazonia, there was a custom a millennia ago for the Indians at that time to take their trash, bury it in dirt, and burn it. And it was, I think, just in their view, simply trash removal. But the net result turned out to be that they had created biochar by burning their trash with a limited oxygen. And they had burned it on the ground, and it eventually became part of the ground. And when the archaeologists were down there trying to figure out what these people's lives were like, they found what they called terra preta, this dark earth, which was incredibly fertile. And as they dug into how come this earth was dark and how come it was fertile, they uncovered the fact that it was actually biochar that these Amazonians had produced. So it's surprisingly low-tech and ancient history. And, you know, you'd think we would have known all about it by now, but now we have to learn about it.
Yeah, and being observant, they probably saw maybe things grew better where they'd done that and begin to do more of it.
That's most certainly what these soil archaeologists have projected.
What Morgan and George have said is worth repeating and summarizing. Adding charcoal to the earth creates terra preta. And from 500 to 2,500 years ago, this additive conferred on the Amazon River Basin soil ancient fertility. The South American Indians cultivated vast gardens with terra preta soil. And that was not what they started out with. Amazonian soils are generally poor and grayish. Some regions mine for bauxite because they are so saturated with toxic aluminum. Terra preta has more plant-available phosphorus, calcium, nitrogen, and sulfur. It also has much more organic matter. It better retains moisture and nutrients and is not rapidly exhausted by agriculture when managed well. The microbial biomass of terra preta is higher than at other forest soils of Amazon. And no one in Europe or Asia seems to have understood the properties of soil charcoal in quite the same way the Indians of South America employed it for sustainable agriculture. In addition to soil fertility, terra preta is a hot topic because the high carbon content of the dark soil drastically reduces the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Charcoal buried in the earth is not just carbon neutral, but carbon negative. It pulls carbon out of the atmosphere. A topic at the UN Climate Change Conference in 2007 was biochar, the modern name for terra preta. Can you tell us about Johannes Lehmann and where he worked as a soil scientist in the 1990s?
Well, Johannes Lehmann, I believe he was writing his PhD thesis down in Amazonia, and he was one of these soil chemical experts who was involved in really understanding how this productivity occurred. And he was one of, I don't want to say the founders, but one of the individuals who really created the mainstream press about terra preta, and he wrote books about it and really got it into more academic journals and really pushed that research in the late 90s. And he's currently a lead professor at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And he's the executive director, I believe, of the International Biochar Initiative and very involved on high levels with policymakers, informing them about terra preta and biochar and the promise of biochar and really disseminating some very good scientific research that's backed by, you know, a lot of different trials all over South America, mainly the southeastern United States. Australia has a bit of biochar research. And it's growing in Europe as well. So really disseminating accurate, we hope, information on biochar and its potential impacts, both economically, socially, culturally, and agriculturally.
Yes, I see how he's stuck his neck out and raised a question that needs to be answered and speculated about what would happen if farmers could make their own terra preta. The Time Magazine News Service quoted him as saying, if biochar could be massively applied around the globe, we could end the emission problem in 1 to 2 years.
Well, that might be a little bit generous of an assumption. That would require a massive coordinated approach globally to do something that still has quite a few skeptics. The costs of this haven't really been determined. The long-term impacts, the true impact on the agronomic practices of the land, what application rates really are best for what lands, how to apply the biochar, how to process the biochar, what biomass sources work best to produce biochar in different locations. So once some of these questions are addressed, perhaps, you know, it maybe by 2020 we could be having a discussion where things are really, really being impacted on the global level with biochar, but we're still a little ways out from that. And that's a very generous quote from Johannes Lehmann. So I'm not quite convinced.
Well, certainly the question that occurs to me is, can the world eat and do what he suggests?
Well, it all depends on where you get the biomass to make the biochar. If people are just harvesting biomass for bioenergy and biochar production, then possibly no. But if the increases in fertility and the growth of some of these crops are impacted as much as some of these reports have projected, upwards of 20 to 40% increase in yield in agronomy, that could greatly lower the amount of fertilizers required and increase the productivity of many of these lands and produce more food potentially. So how that balance it really comes to play has still yet to be determined.
And all the more reason for a local experiment in the Intermountain West.
Well, we feel so, yeah.
And tell us a little bit about what you're going to do.
Well, what we're doing is we've sourced biochar since we weren't able to get a pyrolyzer. There are some companies making pyrolyzers, but quite honestly, they're not all that good yet. They're still working on how to really maximize that process for biochar production. So what we are doing is we're sourcing char from a few different companies that are processing it in different ways with different materials and looking at different application methods that are low-input application methods for pasture lands. We really aren't proponents of tilling up acres and acres and acres of pasture land.
And tell people why you want to avoid that unnecessary tillage.
Well, tilling soil turns over carbon. It exposes root structures and soil carbon pools to decomposition by microorganisms. So by tilling up the soil, you're actually burning carbon both in the tractor that's doing that and in the soil. So we don't think that tilling up 150 million acres of pasture land in the West is really a viable operation. So looking at low impact application methods is one of the things we're looking at in our experiment. We have a few different ideas on how to do that, revolving around the injection of char with a mixture of water or sewage sludge or other liquids, looking at different low-impact strategic trenching methods that can apply large amounts of char by minimizing the soil surface disturbance. So that is one of the ways we're looking at one of the research variables is how to get large tonnages of biochar into pastures by lowering the soil surface impact. Some of the other variables we're looking at are application rate, all the way from 10 tons per acre all the way up to 250 tons per acre. So really getting the gamut of, okay, what is the absolute ceiling for biochar application before negative impacts are observed in pasture land soil communities, and then measuring some of the soil chemical and microbial properties after the application of char over a series of years, really understanding how the soil chemical dynamics are altered, if at all, with these different application rates and application methods, and then really understanding how the soil microbial communities and soil microbial diversity are impacted by the addition of biochar to pastureland soils.
And we'll also be using a piece of ground where we have a history of how much that crop has been producing. We'll use the same crop, but with biochar, and we can measure any improvement in productivity.
And you've been farming that for how many years, George?
Well, I've been farming it since 1972, but it was farmed since probably 1872.
Right. And have you looked at it? Has it been pretty consistent since that time?
It's been consistent under our management because we know the water quantities. You know, we've been traditionally kind of measurement happy, and tons per acre in different crops and water management.
So that'll give you a measurement of the change in the benefit potentially in soil fertility. Do you have a way figured out how you're going to measure the carbon you would take out of the atmosphere?
Well, there are general stoichiometric laws on what the actual conversion of biomass to biochar is with these different processing technologies. So we can get a sense of, okay, so 1 ton of biomass goes into this pyrolyzer. How much biochar comes out? How much energy is required in the process to convert biomass to biochar, the gas, and the liquid? So we do have a sense that it takes roughly between 20 to 35% of the net energy going in as biomass to create the conversion process for those three products, and then you can render upwards of 50% of that co-product as biochar. It greatly depends on the processing method, but yes, that's one of the questions we are going to address, is actually how much biochar can we get out of 1 ton of X feedstock with X processing method, to get an idea on, well, what amount of biomass would be required in the Intermountain West if we were to process it. What could we get out as biochar? What could we get out as the bio oil? And what could we get out as the producer gas in this process? And how much that would cost, not only to produce, but then go on to use those co-products and then apply the biochar to soils.
And if carbon cap and trading started to reach a level in this country as it has in Europe, that would be an additional benefit for you.
Yeah, when we then, you know, obviously it needs to, the economics has to make sense. I mean, you know, I can do a lot of fancy things if you're willing to pay $100 a pound for it. So the cap and trade will put, this is actually a negative carbon, so it would be very valuable, and it would be at the peak price of all this carbon, and that will go into the economics of what the farmer is producing, and
so
probably it may be one of the keys to real profitability.
Yeah, so carbon trading makes sense to you guys.
Yes.
It does, yes.
Actually, it makes sense to everybody, whether they realize it or not.
Well, there seemed to be a locus of confusion in Washington, D.C. right now.
Well, that's true. There's a lot of discussion going on. The Markey-Waxman bill that's being pushed through Congress at this moment. So we'll see what comes out of those discussions and the debates. But we are proponents of some type of carbon cap and trade, or carbon cap and dividend, or what really comes out. We're excited that this legislation is really being pushed through, and we think that biochar could be a solution to some of the issues we're faced with today with soil fertility and climate change.
Well, and it could change everything. I think in one of our earlier conversations, you said to me that renewable energy will only make sense if there's carbon cap and trade.
Either that, or all energy sources are either unsubsidized or equally subsidized. You know, oil is a very heavily subsidized commodity. So for renewable energy to compete with those, it doesn't quite make financial sense without incredible subsidies that are put forth all over the world to encourage the adoption of renewable energy. And I think carbon cap and trade could be an effective way to speed that process.
Is there anybody who's doing an experiment similar to yours on the scale that you'll plan to do here in North America?
Yes, there are. As I said, the United States Department of Agriculture, they have an agricultural research service. And they have 5 locations in the United States throughout the country, in the Southeast, the Northeast, up in the Pacific Northwest, in Iowa, and in California. They're looking at doing similar trials at the same scale, maybe even larger scale, actually doing huge field applications upwards of 10 acres to really get an understanding on how biochar impacts some of the other commercial crops that are readily grown in the United States. So U.S. Department of Agriculture is doing this. Several universities are heavily involved in biochar research, including University of Georgia. I believe Texas A&M has a biochar research arm, and then Cornell.
Does anybody have enough experience to get any data yet that's meaningful?
Well, one of the issues that's being addressed now is actually what data to collect. it's really understanding what tests need to be conducted and how they need to be conducted, and really streamlining that process so everyone is collecting the same data using the same methods. So that is something that is still being worked out, and given that a lot of these trials have only been started within the past year, no data are really available, or no data are available for, you know, I really don't want to project on what those are yet, because some of the tests are still being worked out on what variables to really look for. So we're trying to conduct the same tests as the USDA Agricultural Research Service is doing on their five plots to try to help create consistent data.
So you guys are on a new wave that a bunch of folks are jumping onto.
Yeah, we're right on time.
Good. And if they want to look at your website, there's a lot of information there. Could you tell us what your website is?
Yeah, our website is www.fluxfarm.com, and we have a section that I believe it says something like research articles, and there's a subsection on biochar, and it has roughly 50 different articles on biochar, different scientific literature that's been produced that we feel fairly confident about. There's a few poster presentations on there that, you know, we're not quite sure if their data are quite sound, but it's quality information nonetheless, and I would direct you there if you're curious about it.
Well, thanks so much, and we look forward to maybe doing this conversation in a year and hearing what the first year's outcome might have been.
We really look forward to that.
I'm speaking with George Stranahan and Morgan Williams. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.